Quite a mix on Perspective this week, with some cracking speeches from May Timmold on a request to change the tax status for cohabiting couples and a request to speed up changes to drug laws. But first, Christian Jones's parting gift to Manx Radio, a revealing insight into a 1940s guide on how to sabotage government.
What if the secret to undermining a government wasn't sabotage in the traditional sense, not explosions, not espionage, but something much simpler, insisting everything goes through the proper channels, holding long meetings, referring decisions to committees? It might sound familiar, and those aren't criticisms of modern-day politics. They're instructions from a wartime intelligence manual.
In 1944, during the Second World War, the United States Office of Strategic Services, the body that ultimately went on to become the CIA, produced a document. It was called Simple Sabotage. It wasn't aimed at trained agents. It was written for ordinary people, citizens living under occupation. And it set out how they could quietly disrupt enemy operations in plain sight. Not with complex tools, but with everyday behavior.
System doing everything through channels. Refer all matters to committees. The larger, the better. Bring up irrelevant issues. Promote ineffective workers.
The idea was simple. Small acts carried out by many people could collectively slow down an entire system, waste time, create confusion, undermine efficiency, and in doing so, weaken the enemy from within.
What's striking about the document isn't just what it includes, it's what it redefines.
The manual doesn't just talk about damaging equipment or infrastructure. It focuses heavily on what it calls the human element. Now that means behaviour, decision-making, workplace culture, how people interact inside organisations.
Make faulty decisions. Adopt a non-cooperative attitude. Induce others to follow suit.
In other words, sabotage doesn't have to look like sabotage. It can look like inefficiency or delay or simply things not quite working as they should.
And that's where it starts to feel perhaps uncomfortably familiar.
When you strip away the wartime context, some of these behaviours resemble things people often associate with modern bureaucracy. Long processes, layers of approval, meetings about meetings.
Now, to be clear, those systems exist for a reason. In places like the Isle of Man, government decisions go through scrutiny in Timwald, the island's parliament. And that includes what are known as the branches, the House of Keys, made up of elected members, and the Legislative Council, the scrutiny body which reviews legislation. Proposals are debated, amended, and often sent to committees, which are smaller groups of members who examine issues in detail before decisions are made. And it's designed to ensure accountability and to avoid rushed or poorly considered decisions.
But critics sometimes argue that those same processes can slow things down. Policies can take time to move forward. Decisions can be revisited. And responsibility can feel spread out.
Things do take forever. And you have to be persistent and you have to keep raising matters if you're not a member of the government. If you are a member of the government, you've got the opportunity to be at the table and hopefully influence that way.
David Cretney is a former MHK in which he served as both a backbencher and government minister for a lengthy period of time.
I think it's important that decisions are properly thought through, that they're fact-based rather than anything else. And so there will be a tension there. There will be time required. But, you know, it becomes a bit farcical sometimes, the amount of time that things can be discussed and still make no progress on.
So I suppose it's trying to get that balance right. I mean, looking back, do you think the system generally gets that balance right, or are there times where things become too slow?
Things sometimes do come too slow. We have made progress, and one of the things we boast about as a parliament is we have the opportunity to be nimble. We have the opportunity to make decisions and to get on with things because of our autonomy.
So is that just the reality of democratic government? Or does it echo something deeper about how organisations behave?
To understand that, we need to step back because the Simple Sabotage Manual assumes something quite specific, that inefficiency is deliberate, that it's something people choose to do, but modern thinking suggests something different.
In large organisations, whether governments, corporations or institutions, inefficiency often isn't planned. It emerges from risk aversion, from complex rules, from the need to balance competing priorities.
It happens for the best of reasons. It generally doesn't all happen in a big rush or all of a sudden. What happens is things go wrong. Committees investigate the things that have gone wrong, or officers will investigate a thing that's gone wrong, and they will come forward with a list of recommendations. And certainly if they are a committee of Tynwald, that committee isn't worth its salt if it hasn't provided half a dozen solid recommendations of things that must be changed.
Phil Gawn is a former MHK and held various ministerial roles in his time within Tynwald. He's also Manx Radio's political correspondent.
It is very rare that they come up with a recommendation that says, actually, the process is far too clunky and we need to streamline it. What they tend to say is, this new thing that's just happened, to stop this happening again, we need a whole set of rules, and we'll introduce these rules, and that will stop this thing ever happening again. And sure enough, in most cases, that thing is stopped from happening ever again. But also, the other parts of the area that thing might have been in, they start to become more difficult to achieve because a whole set of new rules have been introduced to stop the embarrassing thing happening again.
And we're exploring this idea that behaviours intended to protect systems, like caution or scrutiny, can sometimes slow them down. Do you think that resonates with your experience?
Well, absolutely. Very clearly it is the case that the systems of government slow processes down. And to a certain extent, some of the processes of government are designed to slow things down. So, for example, it's not directly government, but Parliament, Tynwald, House of Keys, LegCo, that the processes in there are designed to slow things down so that people, our politicians, have the opportunity to carefully consider the impact of whatever the thing is that they're trying to do. And there's a fair amount of sense in that. You know, you can't rush. Well, you're not supposed to rush a bill through. You can actually rush bills through by suspending standing orders. But the general process is designed so that there is plenty of time to consider the implications. There is plenty of time for the public to find out that the bill's going through, to give feedback to members so that it makes sure that you have good legislation. Unfortunately, some of the good processes for lawmaking seem to have kind of shifted over into general government decision making. So you have these very, very elaborate processes which involve everybody's view being taken. Then a response needs to be created for everybody who's submitted a view. And then those responses generally, if they're to be meaningful, they have to have some kind of weight attached to them. So they have to do something. And that then means that you are, in sort of general terms, you are making the process slower. You may end up with better results, but the general view is that anything designed by a committee is less likely to be innovative than if it's designed by someone who's an innovative person.
Do you think it's possible to simplify systems without losing accountability, or do you think that's always a trade-off?
There is a trade-off, certainly, but I think sometimes, well, I not only think it, I'm almost certain that it is the case. The balance has gone far too far in the direction of accountability now, to the extent that, you know, it is reasonably well known that government projects cost between 25 and in some cases 50% more than if they were done by the private sector, purely because there's a whole load of elements in there to make sure that it's a fair and transparent process in which government is spending its money. So more work has to be done than if it was a private sector piece of work where the accountability is just to the shareholders, not the whole population of the island.
If you were, briefly, if you were designing a system today, what would you be doing differently to strike that balance?
And, of course, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If we had the answer to that, we would be, the world would be a much better place. I think members of Tynwald need to be much bolder and much more willing to take responsibility for things which inevitably will go wrong. They have to be prepared to accept that mistakes will be made, and you just have to accept that someone's going to be blamed. Most likely it'll be the minister or the political member responsible, and you've got to live with that. But by living with that, potentially you're going to get an awful lot more done than carrying on with the belt and braces approach that makes sure that all possible, all known risk is managed out of a project, and the inevitable delays and cost that comes with that.
And just lastly, there's a line in the wartime manual that suggests slowing things down through process and delay can weaken a system. Do you think that modern systems ever do that unintentionally?
I not only think that that is the case, but I also think they do it intentionally at times too. You know, if there's a really difficult issue that's... So, I mean, a good example... Now, this is perhaps me being overly political here on something, but a good example is the assisted dying bill. UK government clearly... doesn't want the embarrassment of having two other jurisdictions within its neighbourhood allowing assisted dying, where it still hasn't managed to get the law in place. If I were a minister in Westminster not wanting something to proceed like this, I would be thinking, well, we'll sit on it for a year. We'll let them know when there's not really enough time for them to do anything about it. There'll be an election that'll come up, and it'll potentially be years before anything happens. Now, I may be being grossly unfair on the various UK politicians involved in this, but I know at times where council of ministers that I've been in, and indeed me as a minister, have taken this approach to say, actually, this is a really difficult problem. Let's just sit on it for a while and allow it to sort of time itself out so that we don't have to deal with it. That does happen in politics, no doubt.
In other words, what the OSS described as sabotage might, in some cases, just be what happens when systems become complicated.
So, is it fair to draw a line between a wartime sabotage manual and modern government systems? Probably not directly. One was designed to weaken systems, the other is designed to make them accountable.
The comparison does raise an interesting question. If the same behaviours can exist in both contexts, how do you tell the difference between a system that's been undermined and a system that's simply struggling under its own weight?
The Simple Sabotage Manual was written more than 80 years ago, a wartime guide to quietly disrupting governments and organisations from within. Today, it reads very differently, though. Not as a call to action, but something closer to a mirror.
Not because anyone is deliberately sabotaging anything, but because complex systems left unchecked have a tendency to slow themselves down, to overcomplicate, to get in their own way.
And perhaps the real question isn't whether modern government resembles sabotage, but whether it's possible to build systems that don't.
That was a podcast produced by Christian Jones shortly before he left Manx Radio. If any wannabe MHKs are listening, hopefully you'll be inspired to redress the balance between public accountability and effective decision-making. Next, Alex Allenson put a motion to May Tynwald to encourage government to speed up changes to drug laws. First, a recap from Dr. Allenson, and then a very thoughtful speech from Kirsty Morford, MLC.
It was to drive the progress that we've already made forward into the next administration, to be honest with you. We've been talking about drug law reform for several decades. There was during the debate this constant reference that, well, we can't do anything different to the United Kingdom because we're confined by the various conventions that they've signed up to on our behalf. But actually, when you look around the world, lots of other European countries, American states, have refined their drug laws to really put harm reduction first and either decriminalise or legalise, particularly cannabis for recreational use. So the options are there. And what I was saying is actually we should probably be working with Jersey and Guernsey as a sort of channel islands to have that ability to change our laws that are right for our community rather than what may be right for the UK government at the moment.
I firstly obviously have to highlight my interest as a social worker who worked within the drug and alcohol team on Ireland for 5 years with young people, and I also have a master's in dual diagnosis, so unfortunately this has resulted in my longest speech to date, and this speech will be evidence-based throughout. I want to begin by acknowledging that the policy principles approved by Tynwald in November 2024 set out a constructive and important direction of travel. Those principles are clear. I would like to initially focus on two of these principles, committing us to a harm reduction approach and to ensuring that we develop a proper, evidence-led understanding of the impact of drugs on our community. Those are principles I strongly support, but I do not believe that this motion, as currently framed, is yet fully aligned with those principles in practice. At the moment, we still have a lack of robust local data on patterns of drug use, health impacts, service demand, and long-term outcomes on the island. Without this data, we are at risk of making policy decisions in the absence of a full understanding of their consequences. If we are serious about an evidence-led approach, then we have to strengthen our data collection, improve monitoring of drug-related harms, and also consider the growing international evidence base. Cannabis nowadays is not the low-potency substance it was 30 years ago. Typical illicit cannabis now has THC levels in the region of 15 to 20% and often higher. And, importantly, medicinal products can be of even greater strength than the illicit cannabis. The well-established research on cannabis is very clear on a number of risks. Prolonged reuse and misuse are associated with mental health conditions, including psychosis, depression, and anxiety. There is a clear dose-response relationship, meaning higher THC content and more frequent use increases risk. Cannabis use is associated with a 2- to 3-fold increase in schizophrenia incidents, and importantly, poorer outcomes for those that are already affected. Earlier use, particularly in adolescence, carries greater risk to cognitive development, and we know that neurological development continues into the mid-20s. There is also a tendency to frame the debate as a binary choice between prohibition and legalisation. But the evidence shows that it isn't that simple. We know prohibition doesn't work. History has evidenced this. We know that the war on drugs has not worked. It criminalises users, creates barriers to treatment, and fuels organised crime. International experience has evidenced that legalisation can reduce stigma and weaken illicit markets. But without tight regulation, it can lead to increased use, higher potency products, and rising health harms. In jurisdictions such as Canada and parts of the United States, there have been increases in cannabis use disorder and associated mental ill health, rises in emergency department presentations for intoxication and symptoms of cannabis use disorder, and wider public health pressures. So the real issue is not simply legal versus illegal, it is how a system can be regulated safely. And this brings me to an issue of current concern among practitioners on Ireland, and I thank them for sharing these concerns with me. We are being asked today to consider a future regulated market for recreational cannabis, but we haven't yet resolved the regulatory framework for medicinal cannabis on this island. There are increasing concerns emerging from practice on Ireland. Cases of worsening mental health, including psychosis, manic episodes, and hospital admissions. Reports of dependence, tolerance, and dosage escalation. Reduced engagement with services. Serious concerns around clinical oversight and governance with prescribing. And a lack of consistent review and psychological support offered alongside prescribing. There is also evidence, internationally and locally, that a proportion of medical cannabis is used non-medically, some by young people being sold on, and there can be variability in THC levels and labelling accuracy. NICE guidance in the UK only recommends cannabis-based products in very limited circumstances, reflecting the lack of large high-quality clinical trials. If we are already seeing challenges in what should be a tightly controlled medical context, we need to be cautious about expanding availability before those issues are addressed. Turning to the proposal for a citizens' jury, I recognise the potential benefits. Research shows that they can improve understanding, allow informed deliberation, and broaden participation in complex policy debates. But the evidence on their effectiveness is mixed. They can be costly and resource intensive. Outcomes depend heavily on how they are designed and facilitated. There is a risk of self-selection bias that doesn't fully reflect the population. Group dynamics can lead to groupthink, and crucially, their recommendations are advisory only and are often not translated into policy. Without a clear framework for how outputs will be used, there is a risk that such a process becomes little more than a publicity exercise. Effectiveness depends on recruitment, facilitation, and how those outputs are used. So in conclusion, my concern is not with the principles within the motion taken individually. It is with the sequencing. If we are to proceed with the citizens' jury, we must first be clear on its purpose, its scope, how participants are selected, and how its findings will inform decision-making. Before we consider timelines for implementation of a future regulated recreational market, we must first strengthen our evidence base. ensure we have a robust public health framework, address the current issues with medicinal cannabis, and ensure our services are properly resourced to support any of those who may be affected. That is what a genuine harm reduction approach requires. Without those foundations, we risk moving ahead of the evidence and ahead of our capacity to manage the consequences. We must listen to our practitioners working in the field who are clearly expressing concerns that need addressing, and we must act on any outcomes of the current review taking place. For those reasons, I cannot support the motion as it stands, but I do support moving forward with a measured approach, one that is firmly grounded in evidence, public health, harm reduction, and the current realities and needs of our island. Thank you, Mr. President.
That was Kirsty Morfitt, MLC. Another debate in Tynwald this month considered extending shared tax allowances to cohabiting couples. We'll hear first from Treasury Minister Chris Thomas, then Cabinet Office Minister David Ashford, and finally, mover of the motion, Laurie Hooper.
A commonly used description of a cohabiting couple is two people who live together in an intimate, committed relationship who are neither married to each other nor in a civil partnership. The difficulty is that intimacy and commitment are not documentary facts in the way that marriage or civil partnership is, and that is where the complexity begins. Where a couple is married or in a civil partnership, verification is straightforward. A marriage certificate or proof of civil partnership. For cohabiting couples, verification would be far more subjective, far more labour-intensive and potentially intrusive, requiring judgment calls, evidence gathering, and inevitably disputes. For social security purposes, I understand the stability of a relationship is determined by considering the way in which two people spend their time together and the way that this has changed while they have been together, whether they intend to get engaged or married, on what basis they split household chores and responsibilities, such as cooking, cleaning, and paying bills, whether they are both involved in caring for any children who live with them, whether they tend to spend their leisure time together or separately, whether they normally take joint holidays, whether they plan any future activities or responsibilities jointly or separately, whether the relationship has a volatile history, i.e. the couple is known to have had several splits and reconciliations. Furthermore, the length of time two people have been together is likely to indicate the stability of a relationship, but for social security purposes is not decisive in itself. The fact that two people have lived together as though they were married or civil partners in the past should not lead to an assumption that a stable relationship currently exists.
Well, I understand the sentiment from the Honourable Member for Ramsey, and I'm afraid I won't be able to support the motion today. Now, perhaps before I start properly, I should declare an interest, Mr. President, as I am part of a cohabiting couple. So Mr. Hooper's motion, if it came to pass, could have a direct impact on me. And while I thank Mr. Hooper for trying to make things more tax efficient for me, I'm afraid it's an opportunity I am going to have to decline. The first thing I need to say, Mr. President, I think it's very important to get this on record, is opposition to this motion in no way downplays the relationships cohabiting couples have. As I say, I'm part of one. It's not a refusal to acknowledge stable, loving, long-term relationships outside marriage or civil partnership. It's not an opposition which says only one model of family life has value. Mr. President, modern family life is varied. Many couples live together for many years, raise children together, share homes together, and support one another in every practical sense. That is a social reality, and it would be foolish for any legislature to pretend otherwise. But the motion before us today is not simply asking us to recognise that reality. It asks Tynwald to state that joint income tax treatment should be extended to cohabiting couples and that this change should be included in the next income tax bill brought forward by Treasury. That is a very significant proposition. It's a proposition with legal, fiscal, administrative and policy consequences. In my view, it's not a proposition that should be agreed in principle today without answers to some very basic questions. So the first question for me is this. What exactly is a cohabiting couple for the purposes of income tax? It may sound simple, but it's not. Marriage and civil partnership are legal statuses. They have a clear start date. They have a formal legal record. They have legal consequences. They also have a clear legal mechanism for dissolution. Cohabitation is different. Two people may live together as partners. Two people may live together as friends. Two people may live together for financial convenience.
Right.
Two people... I wouldn't go home if I was you, Mr. Callister. Two people may share a home for part of a year. A relationship may begin gradually, end gradually, or be disputed by one of the parties. If this motion is passed, Treasury will be expected to legislate for a tax advantage based on a relationship status that the motion does not define, and would mean government would have to start defining people's relationship statuses. Mr. President, the present joint treatment regime is not merely a box-ticking exercise. Under Section 65A of the Income Tax Act 1970, where a valid joint treatment election is in force, spouses or civil partners have their income deductions and reliefs aggregated. These are also treated together as a single individual and are jointly and severally liable for income tax, penalties, interest and other amounts due under the Income Tax Acts. That matters. Joint assessment is not simply letting one partner use the other partner's allowance. It brings with it shared tax treatment, shared disclosure, shared administration, and crucially, shared liability. Section 65C also makes clear that an election requires both spouses or civil partners to sign specifically correspondent arrangements and authorise disclosure of tax information to one spouse or civil partner to the other. If we extend that to cohabiting couples, we're not just offering a benefit. We are creating a legal gateway for one person's private tax information to be disclosed to another person. We're creating the potential joint and several liability between people who may have deliberately chosen not to enter a legal relationship carrying those consequences. That is a major step. It should not just be put into the next income tax bill simply because the phrase cohabiting couples sounds fair and modern. The second question for me is, how would Treasury police it? Would a couple have to live together for 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years? Would they need a joint tenancy, a joint mortgage, a shared bank account, children together, or simply a declaration? Would Treasury be expected to investigate the nature of people's relationships? Would officials have to decide whether two people are genuinely a couple or merely sharing accommodation? Would they have to decide when a relationship began, when it ended, and whether it existed for the whole tax year? At present, the Act contains conditions for joint treatment. Section 65B requires spouses or civil partners in broad terms to live together for the whole year of assessment and both be resident in the island for the whole year, unless they both commence residence during the year and meet the relevant conditions. That works because, again, marriage and civil partnership provide a legal anchor. Cohabitation does not provide the same anchor unless we create one. And if we create one, we must be honest about what follows. Either the definition is loose, in which case the system becomes vulnerable to tax planning and abuse, or the definition is tight, in which case Treasury may be forced into intrusive and unattractive inquiries into people's private lives. Neither outcome is attractive from my point of view. The third question, Mr. President, is, what is the cost? The motion doesn't tell us. It does not tell us how many couples would be eligible. It does not tell us how many would benefit. It does not tell us the estimated annual loss of revenue, although the Minister for Treasury has given a ballpark figure in his speech. It does not tell us whether the benefit would mainly assist low-income households, middle-income households, or higher-income households with one partner using the other's unused allowances. That matters because tax reliefs are not free. Every pound forgone through one relief is a pound that must either be found elsewhere, cut from spending, drawn from reserves, or left as part of the wider pressure on public finances. The Isle of Man already provides a higher rate threshold for jointly assessed married couples or civil partners, which is double that for an individual. We are talking about a tax change with real consequences. Before Timwood expresses an opinion in favour of that change, it should have before it a proper Treasury assessment, it should have the numbers, and it should have options. Without that, we are being asked to support a tax policy without any kind of idea what the fiscal impact will be. The fourth question for me is, why should cohabitation be treated the same as marriage and civil partnership for tax purposes, but not necessarily for other purposes? Marriage and civil partnership are legal frameworks. People who enter into them acquire rights and obligations. The tax system reflects that legal status because the law can identify it and also attach consequences to it. If we now say that cohabitation should carry the same tax treatment, we need to ask whether we are creating a partial status, like marriage for a tax advantage, but not necessarily enough like marriage for the wider legal responsibilities that accompany formal legal relationships. That's why this is such difficult territory to be stepping into. Some cohabiting couples may want the tax advantage, but not the legal obligations of marriage or civil partnership. Some may not want either. Some may not want their finances aggregated. Some may not want their tax information shared, and some may not want joint liability. Some may be in relationships where one party has more financial power than the other, and we should be very cautious before creating a system that could place pressure on one partner to enter a joint tax arrangement. Tax policy should not create new vulnerabilities in private relationships. Now, some honourable members may say, Mr. President, the law already recognises people living together as if they were spouses or civil partners in some areas of income tax, and that's true. The Income Tax Act 1970 contains provisions dealing with additional relief in respect of children where a person is living with another as if they were spouses or civil partners. Mr. Hooper referred to that in his opening remarks. But that actually proves the point. Where the law has dealt with cohabitation, it has done so for specific purposes, with specific conditions in a targeted way. That is very different from saying that the whole joint income tax treatment regime should be extended to cohabiting couples. Targeted reliefs are one thing, full joint assessment is another. From my point of view, the motion before us asks Timbald to declare the destination before we've seen the map. It asks us to commit to inclusion in the next income tax bill before we know what the clause would say, what it would cost, how it would be administered, how abuse would be prevented, or how vulnerable taxpayers would be protected. It's effectively, from my point of view, legislating by sentiment, because it sounds right. And sentiment is not enough when we are dealing with people's tax affairs, confidential financial information, joint and several liability, and public revenue. I also think there is a wider point about the tax system. Every time we create another category, another election, another special treatment, and another boundary line, we make the system more complex. It doesn't make it simpler. Complexity has a cost. It costs Treasury time. It ultimately costs the taxpayers. It creates disputes. It creates appeals. It creates cliff-edge cases. Those cliff-edge cases would involve real people, real relationships, and sometimes painful personal circumstances. When did the relationship begin? When did it end? Were they living together as partners or merely sharing a home? What happens if one person says they were a couple and the other person says they're not? What happens if the relationship breaks down after the tax return's been filed? What happens if one partner has tax liabilities the other did not fully understand? Mr. President, we should not use the next income tax bill as a vehicle for what, for me, is an undefined policy. We shouldn't be creating a new tax status before we know what it means. We should not extend joint and several tax treatment into informal relationships without understanding the consequences. So, Mr. President, while I thank Mr. Hooper for trying to make me more tax efficient and ensure that I receive more income in my pocket, I'm afraid I must respectfully decline and I'll be voting against the motion.
Call on the mover to reply.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Members will be unsurprised that I was not expecting government support for this motion. In fact, the Treasury have not engaged at all on this particular item. And it's interesting, actually, hearing some of the objections to it, because they don't really stack up. Like, if the issue is, oh, we shouldn't be expressing an opinion that's quite so definite, usually government would amend something and say, well, let's think about maybe possibly considering something and kicking it into the long grass. That's what I believe the Treasury will be doing with other motions today, just kicking things further down the road. Pretty standard fare for government. So for the government to say, actually, we object to the principle of this, that's pretty firm, actually, from the government, saying we object to the principle that cohabiting couples should be treated in the same way as those who are married for purposes of income tax. And I think the Honourable Member, Mrs. Morfitt, made an exceptionally good point that for some things, government actually does treat cohabiting couples as if they are financially interdependent. For benefits, for student awards, for all sorts of things. But when it suits the government to do so, when it suits the individual to be treated that way, the government says, no thanks, actually, no, you're not really a couple. There's no legal definition of your cohabiting relationship. Brilliant. So let's apply that to Social Security. It's too difficult to define how people are cohabiting, so we shouldn't do it for Social Security reasons. That's the argument the Treasury Minister has just made. It's too hard to do this. What I find really interesting, though, is the objections come to two particular issues. They seem to have coalesced around how do you define these relationships, and then how do you enforce these relationships. So, in terms of how do you define them, Mr. Ashford actually quoted the relevant section of the Income Tax Act, section 39B, talks about people who are living together as if they were spouses or civil partners. That's how the law currently, right now, defines a cohabiting couple. That is the law that the Income Tax Department work off today. That is something which they deal with. In fact, if you want to take advantage of the exception and the allowance sharing that's built into that piece of legislation, there is a form you fill out. It's a two-page form, and it is a self-declaration that you're in a relationship. So as to Mr. Clewitt's concerns that we are moving to a system of self-declaration, yes, we have a system of self-declaration, Mr. Clewitt. That's how our system works right now. Honourable members may be interested to learn when the Income Tax Act was changed. So when did Treasury start doing this? Because you could think, well, maybe it's quite recent, maybe it's new, maybe they're still finding their feet on understanding how to administer this system dealing with cohabiting couples. It was in 2000. It was 26 years ago the Treasury introduced this concept of cohabiting couples in income tax legislation. They have been dealing with this definition for 26 years. But now, of course, the Treasury are saying we can't possibly define these cohabiting couples. You can hear the panic in the Treasury Minister's voice. The question I'd ask the Treasury Minister is, if it is so difficult to define these relationships, how have they been doing it for the best part of a quarter of a century? The answer is, because it's not actually that difficult. The law sets out a test. And I completely agree with the comments that were made around it being an administrative test and not necessarily being applied in a consistent manner. Those are issues that can be dealt with through Treasury policy or even a statutory definition. And if you are going to place a more detailed statutory definition into legislation, an income tax bill, I would submit, is the right place to do that. So far we've heard that it's impossible to define something that the Tax Division and Treasury defined successfully in law 26 years ago. So let's park that concern, because it is quite evidently nonsense. The second issue then comes down to enforcement. We can't possibly enforce some of these issues. Okay. Again, how do you enforce the law as it currently stands? How do you deal with people self-declaring today who may need some enforcement action? Well, Treasury must know how to do this. Like I say, they've been doing it for 26 years. And so when you take those two issues out of the equation, you then start to get into this slightly more bizarre commentary that we've had. You are totally correct, Honourable Members, when you say that a joint taxation election makes you jointly and severally liable for each party's tax. That is a statement of fact. That is fair. But the key thing is it's an election. Joint taxation is not automatically applied to anybody. Joint taxation you have to elect for. It's a choice that you make. If somebody wants to make that choice to be jointly taxed, and that choice to be jointly and severally liable, that's a choice they can make today. I'd like to know how the Treasury polices for coercion within a marriage. Because they don't. They can't. So that argument that says, we can do it safely in this context, because when people are married, obviously there's never any financial coercion in those relationships. So we're happy to accept an election from people in those contexts. But we can't do it when a person isn't married, when people have chosen not to get married or become civil partners. And there may be lots of reasons why they may not choose to be civil partners. And coming back to some of the slightly more, and I'm going to use this word, bizarre objections, I have no idea what's going on in Douglas Central, but the idea of polygamous relationships suddenly being eligible for tax exemptions, I think is quite an interesting one. Because again, we have a definition in law already that says you have to be living together as if you were married. Pretty well understood. So I was not surprised by the Treasury Minister's arguments, by the government's arguments, because they were framed in a very good way. They were framed in this way that said, oh, actually, it's hard to define something that is inherently difficult to define, and that would be too difficult for us to do. He glossed over the fact they've been doing it for 26 years. He glossed over the fact that at the moment we have a self-declaration form that is how you make yourself applicable, how you apply for this current treatment. We also heard from Mr. Ashford, I think, that some people may not want all of the legal liability that goes with a joint tax election. And I think that's absolutely fine. In which case, don't elect. Be treated individually. Pretty straightforward. What I've not heard is a good reason why we shouldn't be saying to people, actually, we have this idea on the island that when you are, I like this phrase from Dr. Hayward, a shared economic and financial reality, when you have this shared financial interdependence with someone, why do we require that you formalise that through a marriage or a civil partnership in order for the state to say, we're happy to treat you as if you are a couple? And why do we only require that when it comes to giving someone a benefit, a support? We don't do it when it comes to making payments for social security purposes. We don't say it's in your interest to be treated as cohabiting here. We say it's in our interest as the state, because we can take all of your income into account. Your household income is taken into account when you're applying for a social housing. But we're not going to take your household circumstances into account for tax purposes. You can't do that. And this idea that I heard from at least two members, I'm pretty sure it came from Mr. Ashford and Mr. Clewitt, talking about this idea that it would cost the taxpayer a phenomenal amount of money, and we can't possibly be looking at giving people a tax break because it would cost the public purse. This is the same government that in February rolled out a universal tax break to everybody on the island. Predominantly, higher earners benefited from that. Those who didn't benefit from that, lower earners. And those who didn't benefit from that, cohabiting couples where one partner does not earn enough to be taxed. Those are the people who didn't benefit from the universal tax break that the government had. And don't forget, in February, a universal tax break was a good thing. It put more money in people's pockets. It drives the economy. It drives local spending. That's what we heard in February. Now, oh no, actually, we can't possibly look at giving people in a cohabiting relationship a tax break because it'll be bad for the public purse. Well, pick a lane, ministers. Either tax breaks are good or they are not good. Pick one. You can't decide that on Monday, something which is excellent public policy is suddenly bad public policy on Tuesday. Crackers. Absolutely crackers. So, honourable members, like I said at the start, this is predominantly about fairness. The motion is broadly worded. It allows the Treasury a lot of flexibility as to how they may decide to roll this out. I would suggest that most of that is administrative, is policy. Because legislatively, we have a statutory definition for what constitutes a cohabiting relationship. We have a process for people to apply for that. And I'm assuming Treasury have an administrative process that sits behind this thing, because they have administrative processes for just about everything.
So I'm going to come back. The mover give way.
No. I'm going to come back to how I started, Mr. President. This is about fairness. We have a concept in accounting which we call substance over form. What matters is the economic substance of a transaction, or in this case, a relationship, not the form that that relationship takes. The legal form of a relationship should not be the thing that defines people. That should not be the gateway to support. Yes, we will help married people, but we're not going to help people who, for all intents and purposes, are married, but have chosen not to get married. That is the very definition of looking at something, the legal form of a situation, rather than the actual substance of it. I think that in Timor we should deal with the substance of issues that we are dealing with. We should not be overly concerned with the legal form that some of these issues take. I have no issue, as has been mentioned already, with the Treasury missing a deadline. If they decide they need to take longer than the next income tax bill to work things out, that's fine. And if that was their issue, they should have amended the motion. They chose not to. Honourable members, I would encourage you to support this declaratory motion, this expression of opinion, that is Timor Court saying, actually, we accept that modern relationships and modern life have moved on somewhat. That actually the Treasury acknowledged this in 2000, 26 years ago. And that it is probably about time that we took those steps just a little bit further. I don't think that asking the Treasury to move the needle once every 26 years is an unreasonably fast pace to move.
That was Ramsay MHK Laurie Hooper, whose motion to extend shared tax allowances to cohabiting couples was ultimately defeated in Tynwald. So what do you think? Was Laurie Hooper right, or was David Ashford right? Perhaps they both were. Did you recognise any of the how to sabotage government suggestions we heard earlier in the programme? If government has become so accountable to the public, why is trust in government at such a low ebb? Health Minister Claire Christian joins us on next week's programme, so one not to miss. I'm Phil Gorn. Goedemorgen, Geisachrom. Thanks for listening.